Hey, folks, you've tuned in for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. We've got an excellent panel today with Marvin Cable and Evan Brown. Marvin has some cases involving Wi-Fi hotspot liability. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about search engines and their responsibility, the Facebook IPO, the Google author EULA, and lots more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 148, recorded February 10, 2012. Hotspot or not? This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, it's Denise Howell, and you've tuned in for This Week in Law. I am so excited to chat with you guys today because we have a great guest, Marvin Cable from Massachusetts, who's going to help us understand an issue that we've touched on the show in the past. And he handles these issues all the time in his practice, has to do with Wi-Fi hotspot liability. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of other things too, but first we're going to welcome Marvin. Hi, how are you, Marvin?
Hi, how you guys doing?
Doing great. It's so nice to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Also joining us is Evan Brown from Chicago, Illinois, and his blog, internetcases.com, and his law firm, Henshaw & Culbertson. Hi, Evan.
Hello, hello. Happy Friday. Thanks for having me.
Happy Friday to you. Great to have you. I think I'm probably doing some crazy video thing with my vest today. Apologies for that for anyone who's watching, but it looks like, what is this? Herringbone? Might not work so well on computerized digital video.
I'm glad you explained it because I was thought that I like took a Vicodin or something before the show. So now it's all making sense.
Don't adjust your monitors. I think it's just I don't know. You know, we are here in Southern California and crazy things have been known to happen. Psychedelic kind of episodes from time to time. So apologies for that. Don't adjust your monitors. I think it's just on our end. Anyway, we've got Marvin here who has a very interesting law practice and I think finds himself at an interesting juncture of his law practice because on the one hand, Marvin, and I appreciate your bravery on coming before our audience with this particular branch of your practice. You represent a lot of rights holders going against people who may have downloaded or torrented their material. Is that correct?
Right, exactly.
But on the other hand, and the reason you got in touch with me to come on the show and get deeper into this issue is that something that comes up in those cases from time to time is whether or not the person, the defendant in such a case, may be actually on the hook because they have an open Wi-Fi connection. And perhaps it was somebody else using their open Wi-Fi connection that was engaged in the alleged infringement. So this has come to be known as the open Wi-Fi defense, and it comes up in these cases from time to time. And there is actually now a trend toward going after that defense, I guess it would say, attacking that defense or negating it through a claim of negligence. Do I have that right?
There is, yes, and I haven't used it yet, and I don't think I will until the law is more feathered out. This is so new that we don't know if this is even a reasonable claim. Essentially, they're saying that, you know, reasonable people should lock up their Wi-Fi routers, and that's creating a new standard for Wi-Fi people or anyone who, gives away internet service that hasn't been there yet.
Right. Now, are you specifically representing somebody who's in this situation, who's been sued in a file sharing kind of case and has asserted this open Wi-Fi defense and now is facing negligence claims or other related liability claims because they should not have left their Wi-Fi open?
Yes, I represented a couple on the defense side, and both of them have settled out of court. But there's only a couple plaintiff's attorneys actually doing this right now. And so there isn't that many people who are facing this issue. And I feel like it should be brought to light at least. So people can either choose to lock up their routers or choose to bring this to debate in some other form.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about, first of all, let's take it from the copyright standpoint, because it seems to me very strange to try and impose copyright liability on somebody simply for having an open Wi-Fi router. And it seems to me like those claims probably get conflated with the fact that, someone supposedly was using this connection for nefarious downloading activities. And the question is trying to find out who that was. Is it possible, do you think, from a legally sound analysis basis, to attach copyright infringement liability on someone simply from having an open Wi-Fi connection?
Well, I see the argument. The idea is, well, someone has to be responsible for these infringements occurring. And if everyone, when they get accused of illegally downloading something, says, oh, I just had an open Wi-Fi router, no one's going to ever be held liable. So this kind of closes the loophole or gap for people just to claim, oh, well, it wasn't me. It was, my neighbor Joe, or it was John or someone else who hacked into my network. So I see the reasoning. And in that case, it is reasonable. But, also it's, I don't know if it'll work with all the other laws that we have in place in America. All the common law of preemption and any sort of constitutional issues. It's tough to tell if this is actually a legitimate claim.
Evan, what do you think, strictly from the standpoint of imposing infringement liability on someone who has an open Wi-Fi router?
I think that's crazy. I think it's a dumb argument to make, and I think it was probably resolved as early as 1998 when they passed the DMCA. I think if the question is copyright infringement liability, the owner of a hotspot should be considered a service provider, as that is defined in Section 512 of the DMCA. And it's the whole fundamental principle here. You don't want to punish the intermediary for allowing others to communicate through its or his or her system. So as far as the question for it being infringement liability for these defendants who are, being brought into that, I think that is a real loser. It's a much more subtle question, a much more nuanced question as to whether or not they are, responsible under some theory of negligence. And I'd be happy to go on for, a number of reasons why I think that is, a loser as well. But suffice it to say, to answer your precise question, if you're going to accuse these people of infringement merely for having a Wi-Fi connection open, that is ridiculous, and that should be dismissed. And I think any plaintiff's attorney asserting that claim should be not only awarded, the defendant should be awarded attorney's fees under the Copyright Act, but that plaintiff's lawyer should be sanctioned under Rule 11, which is what punishes lawyers for filing dumb lawsuits.
Okay, well, that seems like a pretty definitive position from Evan. I think EFF would agree with you. They have an article on this issue. Corinne McSherry wrote it, called Open Wi-Fi and Liability for Copyright Infringement, Setting the Record Straight. And she goes through exactly some of those concerns, in addition to to saying that they ignored a 1932 case about boats that apparently knocks out copyright infringement claims, which I'm looking forward to going and reading at some point at my leisure after the show. Marvin, do you have any, you a moment ago made it sound like there was a bit more wiggle room here for asserting infringement based on this activity. Are you sure you're not talking more about negligence, or do you really think that there's an infringement claim that could lie here?
Well, I don't know what you mean. Explain more.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, distinct legal theories for pursuing liability, you've got an open Wi-Fi connection and you've asserted that as a defense in your case that you're fighting when someone has come after you for downloading liability. And they say, no, no, not only do we think that you may have done the downloading, but in the event it was someone else using your Wi-Fi in an unauthorized way, you still are liable for infringement. Do you think that that works?
Well, I don't. I personally don't like the theory, even being a plaintiff's attorney. And that's partly why I am trying to get this out in the open, because I don't think people are aware of this.
Okay, so let's move on to
it. It's a huge issue because, you know, so many people who, because I've had a lot of people cases. Go ahead.
Let's move on to what Evan was talking about, the second theory that folks are asserting, rights holders are asserting, which is, okay, so, you know, we're going to say that you're liable for the infringement of others, but we may not succeed there. If we don't succeed there, you're definitely negligent in leaving your Wi-Fi router open. You should lock that thing down. You shouldn't just let people come in and use your open connection for nefarious, illegal infringement activities. Evan, what do you think of that claim?
Yeah, I mean, what's going on in a negligence claim against these people who just have unsecured wireless routers in their home, what's going on in there is what the plaintiffs are arguing is that these people had a duty to the copyright holders, Liberty Media Holdings. You know, they make gay porn. That these people who are, you know, putting these wireless routers in their homes just to be there for to have internet access, that somehow they owed a duty to this plaintiff film production company, and that by failing to put the password on there, that duty was somehow breached, and that breach caused the damages to Liberty Media Holdings. Now, that just seems really untenable for a lot of reasons, and I think any first-year law student who has not fallen asleep in his or her torts class would know. As soon as you read a case, there's an old case that deals with the question of duty and the scope of duty. It's called Paul's Graph versus Long Island Railroad, and it's a Judge Cardozo opinion when he was on the appellate court in New York before he was on the Supreme Court. And this was the situation where the woman was getting on a train, and somebody came, and I guess a guy was getting on a train. Somebody came behind him and pushed him. The guy was holding fireworks. The fireworks fell and went off, and then that caused a scale on the train platform to fall over and injure the woman plaintiff. And that was that was totally unforeseeable that was happening. And so, therefore, the person, the defendant, had no duty in that situation to the injured plaintiff. Well, that's the same thing that's going on here, and that's a well-established principle of tort law in negligence. So, you know, that's just what makes this ridiculous pretty substantively. If we were actually to get to the cause of action of negligence, these homeowners don't have a duty to some film production company somewhere. They're not even going to be thinking about those people, nor is it reasonably foreseeable that injury is going to occur, let alone the problems with the actual, you know, causing that. So that's why I think, you know, a negligence action is silly. It's separate and apart from a copyright action, and one can see the difference in the legal theory, because a negligence action requires things to be pled and proven that are not necessary in a copyright infringement action. There's this duty and this breach element. So I don't think a copyright action would be, or a negligence action would be preempted. But substantively, that's why I think a negligence action is is really strange and not supported by this. What I would really like to talk about also is the effect of Section 230, the Communications Decency Act, but that I see that as a different layer. So I just want to make sure that we've talked about everything there is to talk about substantively on negligence before we go into that. But I certainly have some things to say about how Section 230 should make this lawsuit go away before we even get to those substantive points.
Yep, I want to talk about 232, but before we get to that, Marvin, do you have any further gloss on this negligence piece?
No, I don't. The only thing that he didn't bring up was that 1932 boat case.
Yes,
and I still have
tell
to
us about the boat
go
case.
Through that too. You know, I'm sitting here on Wikipedia looking at it, and you know, I'm not the expert. But essentially it says if there's if the burden is less than the cost of injury times the probability of occurrence, then the accused will have not met the stand, will, you know, have a higher standard of care. So essentially, since it's so easy to lock up your router versus all the probable wrong that could occur, that establishes the duty. And so that's the only twist on what was just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the line from Corinne McSherry is Mark Randazza. She's referring to apparently Torrent Freak ran sort of a point counterpoint on this issue and had a couple of essays. I assume you're familiar with the two people, Mark Randazza and Nicholas Ranallo.
Yes.
A couple of good Italians going head to head, it sounds like.
Right.
So they did a back and forth on this, and what Corinne was frustrated about is, you know, it's bad to have a back and forth where there really isn't room for debate on an issue. So she really didn't think that Mr. Randazza's position had any merit to talk about at all. And she claimed that he ignored traditional theories in favor of an unprecedented claim based on negligence and a 1932 case about boats. So he's doing what we used to do when I was grasping at straws in my early years, trying to assert arguments in favor of clients who didn't have too much of a foot to stand on. We would go into those legal maxims. Mm. The old sort of general statements of jurisprudence, and throw in something about how, you know, if the burden is far less than the price that comes, if the burden is not upheld, then
absolutely
there is a basis to forward. Yes.
And it's also...
Go ahead.
It's
go
also
ahead.
Interesting too. Mark Randazza was the attorney for Righthaven that brought down the Righthaven cases. I don't know if you remember those.
Oh yeah.
Now it's kind of like he's on the other side now on mm-hmm. these copyright cases. And I was reading his bio last night, and it seems like to me that he's trying to make law, and he's really interested in putting his mark on the legal system, which is great. You know, he's pushing the boundaries of law, creating new law. But I kind of wonder if he's just doing it for his own personal, ego, essentially.
Right.
I am with you, Marvin. I think the explanation is much simpler than saying that they are being so heady as to resort to maxims to support their claims and all this stuff. Because Mark Randazza is a smart guy, and for many years I've had a lot of respect for him in the things that he has written. He's very sharp, very introspective, but I'm really disappointed that he's taken this approach, and I fear that he has sacrificed his principles on this for the sake of a client he has that's just willing to pay him, to pursue motives that really are less than based on really trying to seek justice in all of this. Remember, we're talking about gay porn here. Let's not obscure that fact. And if people are getting named as defendants or John Doe defendants in all this stuff, everybody knows that people think where smoke is fire. And if you're being named as, you know, if you're being investigated on all this stuff, the instinct, or the at least the first impulse, is going to be to try to, like, wait, I don't want my name associated with this stuff, especially in the public record. So I'll pay whatever you want, plaintiff's lawyer, so that you won't shame me into having to talk about this, even if I'm, you know, completely not responsible for all this stuff. So that's why I really, it really gets my dander worked up with these plaintiffs' lawyers coming and doing this kind of stuff. And, you know, even it gets me upset even when it's with a copyright infringement case. And it really gets me upset now when they're trying to make untenable legal arguments like this that are based on negligence, which are just completely crazy. And, you know, like, and this isn't all that Randazza is doing to just trying to be cute with all this stuff. He's trying to disregard the principles of 512A, you know, which treats the intermediaries, you know, the mere conduits as not responsible for copyright infringement. That he's disregarding those principles, but he's also in some unrelated matters, you know, ignoring precedent when it comes to when you can send a subpoena under 512H, you know, filing lawsuits in Nevada and then sending DMCA 512H subpoenas to folks like Comcast, totally disregarding the holding of the case for the Eighth Circuit and the DC Circuit, admitting in there. I mean, it's just I don't understand why he's trying to be so cute about all this stuff. I think that his principles are being compromised by a client who is not really looking for justice, but just looking to shake people down. And that's really, really unfortunate to see him become a casualty of that. That's how I feel.
Yep, it sure is. Well, let's get to the point that you raised a minute ago, Evan. Section 230 provides broad immunity for third-party go-betweens that we're very familiar with when it comes to things like blogs and newspapers and anything else that might have, you know, a third party using their service to access or express themselves on the internet. How does Section 230 come into it here, Evan?
Section 230 will likely make it so that we don't even have to deal with the substantive principles of negligence. You know, my first comments were actually getting into the elements of negligence and actually looking at the cause of action and what they would have to prove to win in a case like that. I think a court should throw this out on a 12B6 motion where we don't even have to start talking about those things, because Section 230, like you said, provides immunity to the intermediary here. No user or provider of an interactive computer service can be treated as the publisher or speaker of information provided by someone else. So there's a couple of cases that are pretty instructive here. The first one is from 2003. It's called Green versus AOL. And this was the Third Circuit. And in that case, AOL, being the intermediary, was not liable for negligence when there were two people in a chat room. And one guy sent another guy in the chat room a file that locked up the guy's computer. And so he sued AOL, saying, AOL, you weren't doing enough to stop this guy from hurting me. So if you draw, okay, and then so that's that situation. AOL got, the case of, for negligence got thrown out against AOL. Based on Section 230. So that's one case that's relevant. Another case is Doe versus MySpace, which comes from the Fifth Circuit in 2008, I believe. And that's the case, I think we actually even talked about it on the show, kind of when it was happening. The mother of a girl who was assaulted by a guy that the girl met on MySpace sued MySpace, saying MySpace was negligent, didn't do enough to keep these two from communicating with each other and harming one another. Now, and MySpace, the suit against MySpace got thrown out on Section 230, and the court said some really interesting things. It said it was just a disingenuous effort on the part of the plaintiff's attorney to just go about another way of saying that MySpace should be liable for you know, facilitating those communications between the person who says she was harmed by the guy who harmed her. So both of those cases are perfectly instructive in this situation here, because what we have is a situation where one party, Liberty Media Holdings, did I mention that they make gay porn, are claiming that they're being injured by the activity of someone else who they're not necessarily suing, because we're talking about a third party who's logged on to the system, but they're going after the intermediary, saying that the intermediary didn't do enough to protect me, Liberty Media Holdings, from, you know, this harmful actor out there that I'm not even suing yet, and therefore you're negligent. Well, that's really just like these cases, this Doe versus MySpace case and the Green versus AOL case, because all they're doing is saying you intermediary didn't do enough to prevent that tortious activity toward me. And that tortious activity is copyright infringement. Let's not get confused of where our torts are happening here. There's the tortious activity of copyright infringement, which is what they're saying is the source of the harm that the intermediary being accused of negligence failed to prevent from happening. So I think it's pretty clear that Section 230 should protect the Wi-Fi hotspot owner from this. They should be considered a user of an interactive computer service. There's no question, you know, that, like, for example, Comcast is the provider of an interactive service. Well, Section 230, the lesser used part of that, also protects users of an interactive computer service. And if you want to think about it in a certain way, they're also a provider
of an interactive
computer service as well. But you could get them, they could fall under that definition either way. So, you know, I just really hope. Oh, and the other important point on this is I think this is really kind of, this could turn out to be kind of comical, because if these people are getting sued for negligence and not maybe copyright infringement, a lot of homeowners insurance policies wouldn't provide coverage for copyright infringement, but they would provide coverage for negligence. So I bet you that Randazza has a fight on his hand, because these people are going to turn it over to their homeowners insurance carrier, and they'll mm-hmm. cover the defense for all that stuff. And I hope they just litigate this thing to the ground, and that there's some Rule 11 sanctions is what I really hope to see at the end of the day.
Right. I'm hoping that's the first thing you did, Marvin, is tender to your clients, homeowners carriers.
Well, I did. And actually, I did go. I called up State Farm and a couple others. Mm-hmm. And this comes under the torts clause in the insurance. And they have to have pretty good coverage. So not everybody's covered. I should say that it's you're paying almost the max premium if you're going to be covered for that issue.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any success? Have they agreed to provide a defense? No.
No.
Not even a reservation of rights.
No. And it's actually been easier to go about it without having to go through the insurance companies. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that'll change. Somebody will step up and say, I'm going to use the money my insurance gives me to get an attorney and litigate this to the ground. So we'll see what happens.
I'm really interested in this issue, too, from the standpoint of things becoming more and more mobile and more mobile devices being able to fire up an impromptu, very localized Wi-Fi hotspot. And, you know, it's one thing to say that you've got a router in your house and there may be a standard of care that develops if, you know, you have people who help you set up that router, and what you ordinarily do to set up a router is to put some kind of encryption on it, blah, blah, blah. I could see somebody coming in and making that argument in court that if you know anything about routers, you know the best thing to do is lock them down. Now, of course, people could take the opposite side and say, no, we need a more open world where there's more internet access available. But I could see that argument being made. But when we're all walking around with phones and tablet computers, et cetera, where you can flip on a Wi-Fi hotspot for a short amount of time to give someone near you access so that you can share with one another or what have you, you know, I mean, that's part of the selling points of these mobile devices. I could see this liability issue starting to get very widespread and complicated. Marvin, do you have any thoughts along those lines?
Yeah, you just got me thinking, because I have a MiFi, you know, one of those wireless devices that you can have five computers join. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking now also, with the interference that this device might cause, even on an airplane. So now there's a standard to know what your signal is doing, or to lock it up, or to somehow control it. Will this standard be enlarged to not hurt other devices in the area, or not transmit a certain type of signal? So it could get worse, actually. And that's a very good point that you bring up about the mobile issue.
It's got to be really factually based, though, because, I mean, there's a whole body of case law out there that deals with the question of whether or not a commercial premises owner should have to provide a security guard, For example, say that you own a restaurant in a particular part of town. It's a factual inquiry as to whether or not you are breaching or you are complying with the accepted standard of care. Whether you put a security guard there. If you're in a nicer part of town, you may not have to put a security guard there. But if there's a lot of other crime that goes on in the area, the court will look at that and say, yes, it was reasonably foreseeable that crime was going to happen, so you ought to have put a security guard there. The security guard, of course, being the mapping over in the analogy to the password, on these wireless routers. And so are we really willing to live in a world where we're going to say that if I'm just, sitting, in a park bench, let's say in Boston Commons, the place where free speech reigns or whatever, that I'm sitting there and I open up my mobile access point on my Android device, my wonderful Samsung Galaxy 2 that I love. If I do that, is it reasonably foreseeable then that within the however many feet that somebody is going to log on to my open Wi-Fi hotspot and then commit piracy? Good grief. Is that the kind of world that we live in where everybody's walking around pirating content and we owe a duty to all of the porn companies out there to protect them from their stuff getting ripped off? Is that the kind of world we live in? And I'm not yelling at you guys, obviously. I think we're all on the same side of this.
I think we live in a world where, the people with influence and power can get measures put into place that otherwise wouldn't be there. The reason we have an airplane mode on our phones is because of what Marvin was referencing a while ago. The airplane industry doesn't want that interference. And, you talk to pilots and you get all kinds of different answers about whether that's necessary or there's really a safety issue. But the fact is, we now all have airplane mode on our phones. And if you're going to use it on the plane, that's what you're expected to do. So maybe with the power and influence that the content industry has, we wind up with buttons on our phone that we're going to be expected to activate if we're going to use the Wi-Fi functionality. I toss that out.
Yeah. And even more than that, I think there'll be software programs or there'll be different types of routers for coffee shops where they'll have software that put, packets into the signal so that it blocks every, so many signals, so you can't torrent, you can't download this big of a file. There'll be filtering mechanisms on certain routers for certain commercial uses, just like a security guard, but a way to protect from piracy.
Right, and as Nerve is pointing out in IRC, safety is one thing and content is another. But I do think you're in a similar situation where you have, a big industry with an axe to grind, and perhaps that winds up affecting all of the devices that we use. Speaking of big industries, social networking certainly is one, and it's one where only one of the big players I can think of, being Google, is a publicly held company, but one is going to be soon, and that is Facebook. I thought it would be interesting to talk a bit about the IPO from a legal standpoint and some of the information that's come out about the IPO. Over on Read Write Web, there's a good article by a lawyer about the risks involved in investing in Facebook. Evan, you took a closer look at this than I did. Do you want to tell us the high points there?
Yeah, first of all, I tell you what, LinkedIn is listening to you right now and feeling really neglected if you're going to say there
right.
ain't
I'm
no
so button. Sorry. You know what? That's telling that I don't even really consider LinkedIn a social network. But it is, and you're right, it's public.
I've been on record several times before talking about how boring it is. But in any event, they're not a sponsor, are they?
No, not yet. Maybe never.
Never yet.
Bring back the blinking HTML tag and I'll spend more time at LinkedIn, make it more like MySpace. So, okay. What are we talking about? Big risks to Facebook. This is interesting because, You know, one of the more compelling things about the S-1 that Facebook filed, and, you know, that's the document they filed with the SEC when they went, filed for the IPO. You know, they have to be kind of self-aware and realize what the threats are in the industry and look at all that. And so this article in Read Write Web is illustrative of some of those risks. And I guess the big thing, one of the big, I mean, obviously Facebook's, most of its money comes from advertising. And so there are a couple of interesting things to be noted there. And you know, this kind of issue has really been talked about a lot across all of the other commentary, not necessarily, you know, from the legal standpoint. But, you know, the fact that they're not on mobile is, you know, makes a big deal. And that's a big risk to the future increase in revenue, because if people aren't seeing ads on their mobile devices, well, then there's not so much revenue. And we all know that the trend is more toward mobile. So, but I think there are some really interesting things to be said from the legal standpoint when it comes to this risk that Facebook is announcing that pertains to advertising. And that comes along the lines of concerns of privacy that we have. And I wrote a post on internetcases.com, you know, the day of the filing, and there were some interesting thoughts that I had, interesting things that Facebook said in its filing about how there could be changes in the law, and there's always the risk of some kind of privacy brouhaha. And brouhaha was not the word they used in the S-1 filing, but, you know, the possibility that people are going to lose faith in that because of all this. And so advertising and privacy are very closely linked, and that's something that we talk about once in a while. And so you could imagine how Facebook may be quite concerned that there are going to be some changes. Let's just say, for example, if industry self-regulation is not it does not remain acceptable to folks in Congress like John Kerry and John McCain and Ed Markey and Stuart Smalley and those who have talked about online privacy before, there could be some changes coming along that would be adverse to Facebook. The issue I'm kind of skirting around here is do not track legislation. I think that that's something that Facebook might really be concerned about, because that could really affect the efficacy of online advertising. Really, something that could shrink the ability for it to make money in the years in the years, notwithstanding the other big risks that are identified. You know, competition from Google Plus and Twitter, which, you know, of course would face those same restrictions, and also the fact that Mark Zuckerberg is such a powerful personality in all of this. So a number of interesting risks identified. I think that there's still some good discussion to be had on how the legislative change and changes in other regulatory changes when it comes to do not track could affect advertising and thereby affect Facebook's revenue stream. So some interesting things to be watching for in the next few months to a year or so.
The other thing I thought was really interesting, or just kind of ironic, I don't know, my brain looks for funny dichotomies in the situations of life, I guess. And I think, you know, that one thing that Facebook is going to now be subjected to once it becomes a public company is the whole regulatory morass that is Sarbanes-Oxley. And in fact, in their S-1, they kind of lambast Sarbanes-Oxley and talk about how compliance with it is going to be expensive and it's going to increase legal and financial compliance costs and make some activities, to quote them, more difficult, time-consuming, or costly, and increase demand on our systems and resources. But it's so funny to me that Facebook is the company now facing these concerns, because Facebook is generally, you know, up until this point, the company that makes Sarbanes-Oxley compliance difficult for other companies, because it's difficult to bring in all the information that may be relevant, that may be going on, you know, outside the company network on places like Facebook. So I just thought that was kind of comical. But they're definitely, I'm sure that they labored with the decision to go public, as many companies do, because of these reasons they cite, that SOX is going to make life difficult for them or for anybody else.
Are we really supposed to feel sorry for them in all this? Yeah. I mean, it's Facebook. They've got more money than, you know, several countries on the face of the planet and all that stuff. And it's like, you know, we can't get too wrapped up into feeling sorry for them in all of this. And yeah, I mean, sure, it's going to impose an administrative cost on them, and you know, the efforts of complying are going to be to eat into their revenue, and as they say in the S-1, it'll take them off of their core mission of innovation and all that stuff. Well, sure, you know, having to pay the electricity bill takes you off of the business of, you know, off of your mind, off of what it is that you're actually doing at a business. So there's just certain costs of doing business that are there, and so I think we've got to be really careful in not cutting into or underestimating the importance of Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean, I am, you know, I'm not a per se fan of it. I know that it does impose a lot of burdens, but look at what it has set out to accomplish, and I think it has accomplished in large part. You know, it was passed in the era after companies, you know, like Enron and Adelphia and Tyco and WorldCom. And so, you know, we haven't had big scandals like that since then, you know, with investors being swindled. And I mean, so if you ask somebody, you know, living in Texas who lost their life savings, you know, that they had wrapped up in funds or, you know, in investing in Enron or any of these other companies, I don't think they're going to have a whole lot of sympathy for Mark Zuckerberg, you know, who spent almost $1 million last year flying around, him and his family flying around on a private jet. To think, oh, no, he's got to comply with Sarbanes-Oxley. I don't feel too sorry for him, and I don't think a lot of people should either.
Right. Yeah, the other small irony is that companies like Facebook and Facebook itself make it difficult for the whole going public process to happen for everybody else, you know, where you have a quiet period and certain information cannot be discussed or shared with the public. Usually it's Facebook, I would think, you know, leaking things that would make it hard for a company to comply with its quiet period obligations. And now we have that company actually trying to go public itself. I don't know. I just love the sort of delicious irony of it all. Marvin, any thoughts on any of this?
No, I think exactly what Evan said is right. Who I feel bad for are the small businesses that got to comply with the Sarbanes-Oxley. And I think there's some legislation in the works trying to make it easier for small businesses to comply. But I'm not an expert and don't pretend to be. So
the other thing I pulled out as fascinating from the S-1 is this lengthy letter from Mark Zuckerberg that sets out the company's mission and sort of tells potential investors and the SEC where the company is going, what their goals are, and its perceived mission is. And it's definitely worth a read for anyone interested in Facebook or social networking in general. There are a lot of good nuggets in there. One of the things that Zuckerberg says over and over again, or references over and over again, Facebook is often held up as a company that is a threat to rights of privacy. And what he talks about, he flips that on his head and talks a lot about the right to share and how, here I'll quote one little bit of it, through this process, we believe that leaders will emerge across all countries who are pro-internet and fight for the rights of their people, including the right to share what they want and the right to access all information that people want to share with them. So, you know, as they face the wrath of organizations like Epic when they run afoul of certain things, they're advancing this agenda that, you know, maybe the right to share is perhaps every bit as important as the right to privacy. What do you think of that, Evan?
All this language you got to take with a grain of salt, because you know, it's the objective of writing this letter is to be somewhat persuasive, because Facebook knows that prospective investors are going to be reading this, and so you don't want to just say, "Oh yeah, no, we are a company, and we all we care about is getting rich, and we care very little about how you feel, you users being the product, and all that stuff." So, you know, I take it all with a grain of salt, and but you know, this is a legitimate thing that he's saying here. And it's one of those things that resonates with people, seeing how there are benefits from open communication and the open channels that Facebook provides. But at the end of the day, we also got to remember, you know, that Coca-Cola would say, we don't really care about making money. We just want to provide people with yummy soft drinks. And nobody's going to bat an eye at that. They're just going to say, that's Coca-Cola talking. And so Facebook is going to say these things as well. And there's plenty of warm and fuzzy things that we can that they can put in there to kind of make it more readable.
So what do you think, Marvin? Are you going to invest?
Well, yeah, I like to give people the benefit of doubt. So maybe they are the warm and fuzzy and do no evil type of company. But, you know, time will tell. We don't know.
Yep. The chat room wants us to start answering the phone as the law firm of Twill, Brown, and Cable. So, is that your phone that's nearby, Marvin?
Yeah, and I keep turning it off. I don't know what's going on.
That's okay.
Sorry, everybody.
Someone trying to phone in a question, no doubt.
Yeah.
It's Julius Jenikowski.
Or they're reminding us that now would be a good time to take a break and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Netflix. Netflix, of course, you probably well know by now, streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, saving you time, money, and hassle. And there are so many different easy ways that you can instantly access all of that amazing material. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac or PC or iPad. You can watch on your iPhone and some Android phones too. Any gaming console that you're likely to have in your house, be it an Xbox 360, a PS3, or a Nintendo Wii, will bring Netflix right into your living room. Or if you're not a gamer, you can watch on your TV with an Apple TV, a Roku box, any number of other options out there will bring Netflix straight to you. And once you've got it, you can watch instantly using any of those devices. You can start watching on one device and finish on a different one. Whichever way you choose to access it, you can watch as many movies or TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. Recently in our life, I've got to tell you, the best use I've found yet for Netflix is to have my offspring understand what it is I'm talking about. My son was playing in a basketball league and was a little bit disappointed in himself that he wasn't making all his shots. So I told him maybe he should just go wolf and that would solve his problems. He had no clue what I meant. So we, of course, had to come down to one of our many Netflix-enabled devices and fire up Teen Wolf so he would know exactly what I meant. And the great thing about Netflix is when you go into their catalog and you find something you're interested, like the great 80s classic movie with Michael J. Fox, you learn things like that they remade that movie in 2011. I've never seen that one, but I'm sure that my son will probably want to see it. So there's a new sort of reimagined Teen Wolf made last year. There's also a Ski Wolf movie that we never would have found out about were it not for Netflix. So it's a wonderful tool, and we really appreciate their support of This Week in Law and the TWiT Network. And you can have your own adventures on Netflix all for free for 30 days when you go to netflix.com/TWiT. Do use that code because it helps them know that we sent you their way. Give it to your friends, anyone you might know who wants 30 days for free of this great service. And we really thank them for their help with putting on This Week in Law. All right, guys, let's see. What else should we discuss? Little update to the iBooks author, Eula. Seems that iBooks was paying attention to all the people who thought it was pretty bad that there was language in there that made it seem like Apple could own or control the distribution of all of the material created with iBooks author. And that has now been changed. The EULA has been changed. And the language in there is meant to address that very issue. Evan, were you paying attention to this at all?
Yeah, I looked in that. I mean, it seems to, you know, Apple certainly did not retreat from its position of wanting a certain kind of exclusivity for the distribution of, you know, the commercial distribution of works generated with the application, but certainly does make it a little more palatable in as much as the limitation on what you the scope of those things that you have to distribute on, through the iBooks author is limited only to those particular files. Is it like .iBooks files?
Mm-hmm. So, right. So I'm, you can use the tool. You can use the tool to create other file formats that it supports, and then you can sell it commercially anywhere you want. But if you create it in the iBooks format, they think that that should only be in the iBooks store.
Yeah. You see, that's a question that I had. I haven't used the application, so I was wondering if it was even possible to actually export finished product in formats other than iBooks. And if that is the case, if you could not export it in any other formats, then this amendment really would have no practical effect. But if you're saying that you could just like export it as an EPUB file or something like that, then this really is quite more liberating. So it depends on mm-hmm. what you can actually do with it.
Yep. And there's more about this over at PC Magazine by Damon Poeter, if you want more of the details on this. Any thoughts, Marvin, on this sort of back and forth that Apple has been going through?
No. And I called a couple of my friends this morning to ask them what they thought about it, and they totally disagreed with it. So I think it's kind of unanimous, at least, that this is kind of ridiculous if unless there is an export feature to EPUB or PDF. So, but I don't mm-hmm. know, and neither does Evan. So,
no, there is. I mean, it will let you generate works in other formats besides iBooks, and those. They're not purporting to control. So, but that's a change from the original EULA. So that is good news for all of you potential ebook authors out there because it's supposedly a great tool. Okay, let's take a look. Evan, we were talking last week about whether there would be any liability associated with the government's actions against Mega Upload, and you had done some posting on that. It looks like someone has tried to pursue the FBI in a lawsuit about this. Can we talk about that for a minute?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know. Did somebody actually file a lawsuit over
someone
this?
Someone has filed, yes.
Oh, I didn't.
Alleging the FBI has caused incalculable damage far in excess of the losses claimed by the content lobbies in a fruitless attempt to prevent access to the media hosted on Mega Upload. So there we go. We're off and running.
Oh, wow. Because I didn't know that anybody had actually filed a lawsuit. There were a bunch of people at the end of January talking about that and grumbling and, you know, especially people overseas. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that's really easy to get upset about, but I think it's going to be pretty difficult to go after the government because of sovereign immunity, which we discussed last week, and you know, any other kind of cause of action like a Fifth Amendment taking is going to be problematic, just you know, kind of on the face of what the Fifth Amendment takings clause says there. So I'll be excited to see where this storyline goes. But I didn't know.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure anyone has gone to a courthouse with a complaint and filed it yet. This the article I'm looking at from The Raw Story talks about organizing a bunch of plaintiffs in such a lawsuit. So I'm not sure if that has come to culmination yet. Marvin, this is a bit in your bailiwick as far as...
What do you think about all this? I don't know. I don't know too much about it either. I haven't seen anything filed, but it's definitely an issue. I know I'm on certain email lists, and this was a concern. I mean, you're taking other people's property, and some people are legitimately, you know, sharing things that are theirs, or, they put up their MP3s there because they want to store it there, you know. So there's legitimate issues here. But again, fighting the government, that's going to be a tough one. I'm sure they thought about this before they initiated this whole scheme. So difficult.
A couple of tech dirt things I thought were worth mentioning here. Number one, there's a great comic from the Tom the Dancing Bug series that takes on the excessiveness of both copyright extension and enforcement. And the point that Mike Masnick made by posting this, I think it was Mike, yeah, it was, is that we're now to the point where the excesses of copyright are the forms of fairly mainstream comic strip fodder. So I wondered what you guys thought of that, Evan.
This is great. I mean, it's so funny because the superhero is, you know, leaving the scene of where 27 billion whatever kind of aliens are being, you know, the subject of genocide and jolts across the cosmos and tears down someone's house and rips out all their wires and stuff because they're, what was he trading? Like Lady and the Tramp?
So,
I mean, that is really what God as superhero should be doing. And it's a shame that that's not the way the world really is. The only thing that would have made this comic more effective for me is if the superhero would have actually been, had the face of Mark Rendaza and dressed up as the Statue of Liberty or Liberty Media Holdings. That would have really hit the point home for me.
Yep, that is lovely. What do you think, Marvin?
No, that I was thinking the same thing, actually. If they could have put some reference to what's going on, maybe even a little troll hat or something, I don't know. But yeah, it is pretty funny.
All right, and then the other tech dirt item I wanted to call out had to do with, we've talked a bunch about the show, about the assertions on the show, about the assertions of the Hollywood folks as to how badly piracy damages them. And so there's a good infographic that Steve Blank put together that Mike featured over on Tech Dirt that sort of takes you on a timeline through innovations and how they've impacted businesses and how the content industry has really only benefited as these things have gone along. Marvin, do you have any thoughts here?
No, not really. You know, I'm looking at it as it's scrolling through. Not really. Sorry.
Okay. I'm sure some of your clients would probably take umbrage at you saying anything too critical of their assertion that they have been damaged by piracy. So we'll right. certainly forgive you if you yes. decline to do that. Evan, what do you think?
Well, I guess the thing that I tried to see from this infographic is the theme that it's kind of a recurring pattern, and we know about this. We talk about this all the time. It's that a new technology is introduced. It's disruptive. It challenges the position of the incumbent being the content industry, those who are there and who are making money on the status quo. And so they freak out. They file lawsuits. Those often make it all the way up to the Supreme Court. But then somehow the technology is integrated and adopted and makes the content industry rich. So if we look at this this pattern that starts way back in what the first entry here on this infographic is with Thomas Edison inventing 35 millimeter film strip. If we were to just extend this forward, because where it ends is like, you know, SOPA and PIPA and the out about all that and, you know, the internet blackout and all that stuff. So what we should see if this pattern is going to continue is some integration of modern new and innovative disruptive technologies into content industry, the content industry figuring out what that is, and that perhaps may mean the content industry changing by, you know, its very nature and character, which should result in a greater public good, something that serves the public interest, that being, you know, high quality content, something as awesome as, I guess I'm like 3 years behind because I'm thinking like, you know, the best example is like Avatar. Avatar is just so freaking awesome. Nobody's going to make that without investing a bunch of money. What we'll see is a combination of both, awesome content that could only come from big content with more radical and disruptive means of technology. Help me out with like a 2012 kind of example of just a movie that's like has totally awesome special effects and stuff.
I don't know if we've had any in 2012. Yeah. I went and saw Red Tails recently. It was pretty good.
Yeah.
But not, of Avatar ilk.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe that's because we have killed the content industry and maybe. Nothing good has come out since 2009. Is that what's
YouTube.
Happened?
YouTube. Yeah.
Something has killed it. Well, we were talking earlier about strange forms of liability being attached to people who sit in the middle of providing information. Here, somebody with an open Wi-Fi hotspot, we were talking about, let's talk about search for a minute, because the search industry is frequently subject to people wondering about their responsibilities and, you know, if they're pointing at infringing activity, they may have liability that attaches to that. There's an editorial over in Slate that I found pretty interesting, wondering about, it was by Evgeny Morozov, and it was wondering about whether Google and other search engines might have a responsibility to help stop the spread of 9/11 denialism, anti-vaccine activism, and other fringe beliefs. So I suppose a fringe belief we could pull out from today's discussion would be the belief that copyright infringement or negligence liability could attach to you for having an open Wi-Fi router. But the assertion is that perhaps Google and others should do more to filter search results so that things that, you know, there's consensus that they're just flat out wrong in the scientific or medical community, for example, would be more difficult to find. What do you think about this, Evan?
Well, I see the point. And, you know, the author of this piece is raising an interesting issue. I really didn't get a sense of where the author was coming down on whether or not Google should do this more than just like presenting the question. And so you can see the interest that would be served by requiring that intermediaries somehow filter content so that fringe theories are taken off. Because what I think happens a lot of time is that there's a lot of confirmation bias where people are, they come to a particular issue, like whether it be we didn't go to the moon, 9/11 was an inside job, vaccines cause autism. What are some others? You know, there could be some crazy other conspiracy theories du jour. But even in more other more mainstream debates like SOPA and PIPA, what you see is people coming to a debate, coming to an issue with a preset schema, a certain way that they're going to see this and a certain conclusion that they're going to only go out and find facts to support that schema or to fit into that schema, or they're going to interpret facts in a way that even if those facts are somewhat objective, they're going to put a spin on them so that they can mesh with this viewpoint that they have already. So there's a real danger that content, these fringe theories will kind of get their own energy and start being, you know, like these negative feedback cycles and little weird loops of strangeness that are out there and go out there into the nether parts of the web, headed up by, like, you know, the Jenny McCarthys of the world and stuff. But my response to the question of whether or not the intermediaries like Google should be required to moderate this and to restrict this is an emphatic no, absolutely mm-hmm. not, because I see ideas in terms of a Richard Dawkinsian kind of framework of memes. You know, the idea of a meme is connotative of genes, and so good ideas go out there and exist in the ecosystem that is conversation and dialogue and all that stuff. And just like favorable genes will be able to overcome selection pressures in a Darwinian kind of sense, and the good genes rise to the top, survival of the fittest and all that stuff, the same way with good ideas. So what we want on the web and in the world in general is kind of like what would be the analog to biodiversity. We want all these ideas to be out there, and mm-hmm. we want the ecosystem to be healthy. If we were to require Google to come along and start filtering these ideas, that would be akin to somebody coming along and just dumping pesticides on the ecosystem of ideas and killing out all these ideas that in Google's judgment or in the judgment of those regulators who are mandating Google to do this, and you kill out all this biodiversity and you're going to have just much more homogenous thought that I think that it's pretty well established that, you know, that should not be encouraged. There's we're much richer. We're much more prone to advancement if the ideas can go out there and spawn and respond to the selective pressures and be held up to the standard of reasonableness and rationality and evolve in a way that I'll be so bold as to say as how nature would intend.
Hmm. Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. This the notion that you have either a browser or a browser plugin or a search engine who is performing this paternalistic role of deciding what information is vetted and what is not is a little chilling to me. It kind of makes me cringe a bit. The author here points out that Google does something similar for users who are searching for terms like ways to die or suicidal thoughts by placing a prominent red note urging them to call the suicide prevention hotline. So it seems like, you know, they will in some circumstances jump in and say, hey, we see you're searching for something bad and we want you to have all the information that we think it's appropriate for you to have. But were they to take that much further, I don't know that I'd be very comfortable with it. What do you think, Marvin?
Well, I agree with you guys in principle, but also, too, you can manipulate search results. You know, I spent a couple hours on the phone yesterday with a reputation management company who specializes in search engine optimization and getting certain ideas to the top of the results. So if Google can filter these propped up ideas, I think that's a good thing in order to create more diversity. So there's an issue too in not allowing Google to filter these things or not forcing Google to filter things.
Right. So hands off Google, I think is where we all fall, which I'm sure Google would like. Let's see if we've got anything else that we haven't covered here that looks interesting. Oh, yeah. So, Evan, do you want to know what, how and whether and in what way your smartphone may be tracking you?
Oh, my gosh. Can you tell me?
Well, some legislators would like you to know, and they have...
I have no idea who those legislators might be, but tell me.
I think they might be.
I didn't see Stuart Smalley on the list, so it must be our good friend Bismarcky Mark, right? Or something like that.
Yes, exactly. The Mobile Device Privacy Act is the new proposed bit of legislation. Seriously, is there anything wrong with this, or is it just kind of a belt and suspenders move?
It looks like there might be some negative unintended consequences from this because, you know, Carrier IQ, I mean, what the bill's doing is essentially requiring that people whose phone and information are tracked, like what Carrier IQ was doing, that, you know, that was the whole controversy late in 2011. What it requires carriers to do is to disclose to the customers that information is being collected about them and that they get their consent to collect that information. And I think the thing that's most new under the sun is that the carriers would have to create a secure database about, you know, with for the information that's collected. And so therein lies the potential negative unintended consequence on this is that at least Carrier IQ is saying that, you know, that's exactly what we're not doing right now. And that's a good thing that we're not doing. We're not collecting these big dossiers about people. But this legislation unwittingly is putting people at greater risk of having their activities tracked because it mandates that this database be established when we can really do our job, we being Carrier IQ, without doing this. And that's actually really all we set out to do is just, you know, like make coverage better. So if that's the case, then, you know, it really needs some serious thought given to it. And it's interesting to see how little, you know, negative consequences like that can make their way into something that ostensibly is benign from the get-go. So I hope that that can be resolved one way or the other.
So Marvin, Edward Markey is in your neck of the woods, Massachusetts. Do you have any thoughts on the Mobile Device Privacy Act?
You know, not too much. I had actually called a couple programmers this morning to see if, you know, because a lot of times these smartphone companies say that they collect this information and make their devices better. And, you know, and I talked to a couple programmers and they said that's all BS, that, you know, it, they don't need this information at all. So I think that, you know, the bill looks good except for those unintended consequences, like Mr. Brown said.
Yep, that's an excellent point, Evan. By shining the light closely on the issue, you may wind up aggravating it. But I don't know that. I don't know that this is one of those, like, going back to the legal maxims. I think that it probably weighs heavier on the side of discouraging a lot of data gathering than it does encouraging it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll be proven right. All right, so we have a tip and a resource of the week for you. Avner Ronan over at Boxy tweeted at me something that, this is going to be our resource, something that they posted over on the Boxy blog. There is an FCC rulemaking that cable companies are urging forward that has to do with doing away with unencrypted cable access, I believe. I'm not going to pretend to understand all the nuances of this, but basically what you're not going to be able to do anymore is plug your cable cord directly into something like a Boxy box. You're going to need a cable card to be able to access that information. I remember you used to be able to do this with TiVo too, and I think TiVo now requires cable cards. So it winds up costing you more money if you want to route your cable signal to a separate device like Boxy, or it requires you to have a cable company issued set-top box. So Boxy's concern here is that they're being shut out and there's nothing in this rulemaking that that actually is consumer friendly at all. It's all of the concern here is for the cable companies themselves. So our resource is this write-up by Boxy, and they also point to, let's see, Public Knowledge's blog post on the same topic if you'd like to know more. And if you do want to know more, they also include a link to contact the FCC about this and be able to weigh in if you have opinions about how you'd like your non-cable provided set-top box to be able to access the cable signal. Guys, have you looked at this? Any thoughts? Evan?
It reinforces the idea that users are the product, not the consumers. And along those lines, it's discouraging that something like this would happen, which would stifle innovation. You know, with that's why Boxy would be upset, and it's also discouraging that content owners would look for ways to have the means to be more restrictive on all of those things. So it implicates privacy, it inhibits innovation, and it also has some copyright intellectual property issues as well. So this is something that's worth watching for sure.
Right. Thank you, Avner, for bringing that to our attention. And I've got actually one more resource before we move on to our tip. It's related to the tip. Over at EFF, we've been talking about open wireless and the liability considerations. There's another post at EFF from Peter Eckersley this time about the need for an open wireless movement and the wireless world we ought to be living in. Mr. Eckersley argues, is one where, you know, we have the most access possible and there should not be friction to accessing the internet in any way. And so, you know, by encouraging encryption on networks that don't really need it. We're basically trashing the commons and stopping the access that we could be having. So there's a long article there about the future of open Wi-Fi and also the open wireless movement that EFF wants to spearhead. So the tip that I put as the complement to that resource is if you're going to embrace the notion of an open wireless movement and not be concerned that someone may come and subject you to liability for file sharing or something else by using your connection for something you did not anticipate or authorize, you might want to pay attention to your ISP's terms of service. Because over at Awaiting Inspiration, Adam, the author there, pointed out and went through and read the terms of service of Comcast and Verizon and various other ISPs that actually prevent you from leaving your Wi-Fi access open, that it's a violation of their terms of service and they can terminate you as a customer if they find that you have done it. So yet another bit of fuel for the fire that there might be some argument that on a home router, there's a standard of care in place that you might have to lock it down, because if the ISPs are saying you should, then that certainly is evidence toward that end. So if you are going to be an open wireless supporter, do check your ISP's terms of service and see if that might result in suspension of your service. Let's see. Marvin, any thoughts here?
Oop. About the EFS or the terms of that
the terms of service, yes, that you might not be able to actually keep your internet access if you're sharing it around.
I had no idea that even existed, but that would be even more advantage and tool for Mark Randazza, and that kind of worries me because that establishes the care, but. On the defense side, I think that's kind of unconscionable, and I think most users don't know that, and it's akin to a shrink wrap agreement. I mean, I didn't know it, and I'm a pretty technical guy, and I'm involved in these cases, so that bothers me. And thank you for bringing it to my attention. Actually,
sure, Evan, do you think, as Marvin is suggesting, that this sort of term may not be enforceable?
I don't have any doubt that it's enforceable. I mean, this would be something that's in the terms of service that you agree to when you sign up. And, the courts have routinely held those to be enforceable, and things like forum selection clauses and stuff like that. But I wrote a blog post way back in 2006, which was like, about 150 years ago in internet time.
Sure.
If you remember, there was a startup called Phone, F-O-N. And I don't know if it's still around, but if you just do a Google search for Phone, F-O-N, and internet cases, my blog. It's a post that I wrote, on February 10th, 2006. So that was
How about that?
That was, 6 years ago today. And, what Phone was this idea where you leave your hotspot open and then, like, others can come and get on that as they're like traveling, say they're in the area and they need Wi-Fi access or something, that you kind of join this network and you become one, say, hey, you can log on to my hotspot and access my internet connection. And so, I remember, it came across my consciousness then, what would be the effect of that in relation to whether you have breached the terms of service. And I can't remember if I actually mentioned that in this blog post, because I later wrote an article that was in the Journal of Internet Law that really examined more in depth the liability for Wi-Fi hotspot operators, for third parties who are getting on that network with or without permission. But in any event, Comcast is, of course, going to prohibit this kind of open access for a number of reasons. You know, they don't want bandwidth to be used disproportionately. They don't want people using their home internet for commercial purposes, you know, charging $5 to the neighbor to be on there. And, you know, who knows if they were prescient enough to envision lawsuits by aggressive plaintiff copyright holders for negligence. You know, if the Wi-Fi operator, you know, if the consumer is negligent, what's to stop the plaintiffs from going ahead up the food chain and saying, well, Comcast, you were also negligent by not telling your subscribers to not do that. So that would be kind of a backstop for Comcast liability if aggressive plaintiff content owners were to say that they were negligent by not by providing the stuff through which their poor clients, content producing clients, were being injured.
All right. Well, with that, I think we've had a great show today. Thank you so much, guys, for joining me today and talking about all these interesting issues. Marvin, it's been a pleasure meeting you.
You too. It was a pleasure being here. Thank you so much.
All right. So you're Marvin Cable on Twitter. Is there anywhere else where people can find you off the show?
MarvinCable.com, and that's about it.
All right. Really a pleasure, and keep us posted on what's going on in the cases.
Absolutely.
Where you're representing folks with open Wi-Fi access points. Evan, it's been wonderful chatting with you again.
Yes, as always. It was a lot of fun. Marvin, thanks for being on the show and raising some really interesting issues. So I've really enjoyed my my time here today. So thanks to everyone.
Yeah, me too. And I'm glad
we
could.
It's good to meet you.
Glad we could go back and do a on this day in 2006 from Evan's blog at the end of the show.
Yeah, it's always good. Always good.
Yes. Twill is not on the air. You can find us as well. You can email me at denise@twit.tv. This Week in Law has pages both on Google+ and on Facebook. If you like to find, you know, be up to the minute on when the show comes out, when it's available, if you're not listening with us live every Friday at 11 Pacific, 1900 UTC, Twill also has a Twitter page that just lets you know, hey, show's out now. And I put the links to the things we're going to talk about in the show on the Facebook page for the show and also into my Google+ feed as well. So definitely get in touch. Let us know what's on your mind. We love talking about those critical issues at the intersection of technology and law. And we love knowing what's on your mind as you comb through the internets looking for those issues too. So we'll see you next week. Take care, everyone.